Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Absolute Madness tells the disturbing true story of Joseph Christopher, a white serial killer who targeted black males and struck fear into the residents of Buffalo and New York City in the 1980s. Dubbed both the .22 caliber killer and the Midtown slasher, Christopher allegedly claimed 18 victims during a savage four-month spree across the state. The investigation, aided by famed FBI profiler John Douglas, drew national attention and biting criticism from Jesse Jackson and other civil rights leaders. The killer, when at last he was unmasked, seemed an unlikely candidate to have held New York in a grip of terror. His capture was neither the end of the story nor the end of the racial strife, which flared anew during circuitous prosecutions and judicial rulings that prompted cries of a double standard in the judicial system. Both a wrenching true crime story and an incisive portrait of dangerously discordant race relations in America, Absolute Madness also chronicles a lonely, vulnerable man's tragic descent into madness and the failure of the American mental health system that refused his pleas for help. The book that we're featuring this evening is Absolute Madness, a true story of a serial killer, race, and a city divided, with my special guest, journalist and author, Catherine Pellinera. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Catherine Pellinera.
Hi, good evening, Dan. This is Catherine Pellinero. It's very, very nice to be speaking with you.
Thank you very much. This is an incredible story. Like I had mentioned just previous to this, I had not heard of this, and I can't believe what I just read, and this book is fantastic, and I'm sure the audience is going to be very, very fascinated with this story. I mentioned...
Oh, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Let's talk about how you came to be the author of Absolute Madness. How did you come to be in a position? Why did you want to write this book? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, my first true crime book was Kitty Genovese, which was published in 2014. And in May of 2014, I was on my way to Buffalo, New York, which also happens to be my hometown, to do some publicity appearances for Kitty Genovese. And, of course, the question was coming up, well, what's your next book going to be? And I actually had no plans for another book. I had spent 7 years altogether on the Kitty Genovese story. And, you know, delving into another book was sort of, in a way, the last thing on my mind. As I was on my way, I was talking to my sister on the phone, one of my sisters. And she was telling me, you know, you should think about writing the story of the .22 caliber killer. And I told her, you know, I don't really remember that. I mean, because it had happened in our hometown, the killings had started in Buffalo in 1980. And, you know, I was a kid at the time, and all I really remembered was the headlines. I really didn't know anything about the story. I remembered the headlines about the .22 caliber killer and something about two cab drivers being murdered and having their hearts cut out. But, you know, I told her, I just don't remember anything about it. She said, well, you know, while you're there, look into it. It's a really, really heartbreaking and compelling story. It's never been told, and, you know, I really think you should look into it. So while I was there, I spoke to a friend of mine in the Erie County District Attorney's Office, and, you know, he did some checking for me, and he came back and said, well, you know, if you do decide to write about this case, we have all the original files. We have, 22
wow.
boxes of the original files, and they're, you know, you're welcome to them. Now, it turned out there was more than 22 boxes, But so that, I mean, that's certainly a great offer for a true crime author. And also, my father, Salvatore Pellinaro, was a Buffalo police officer for 34 years. And he passed away in 2005, unfortunately. But, of course, he knew many, if not all, of the Buffalo police officers and some of the state police who had worked on the case. So my first thought was, well, maybe I'll look into it because it will, you know, kind of maybe an excuse to spend a little time in the hometown. I thought maybe I'll write an article about it or something. But the more I started looking into the case, I went from a feeling of, well, this might be interesting to, oh, my God, I've got to tell the story. Because it was so different than anything I had heard. Now, even keeping in mind, I only remember the headlines, but I did go back and look up some of the archival news footage. And it was, the storyline was always, these were racially motivated attacks. It was this white serial killer. Nobody knows why he did this, but he went around and he started killing black men at random. So now when I write, my approach to nonfiction, and particularly to true crime, is I try to be as absolutely thorough as possible. I started out as a playwright. My background is as, in the theater, where the focus is completely on character. And I approach even real people the same way. In other words, I try to learn as much as I possibly can about them. So I started looking, I look into the case and the case files, and I start digging into the background of Joseph Christopher, whose name I didn't even know when I started working on this case. So I really had no horse in the race as far as, you know, I thought the story should be one thing or the other. I mean, I really, you know, really had no vested interest in it, if you know what I mean. Whatever the story was, that's what I was going to write. So as I started looking into it, this is a case where it had always been advertised as this racist serial killer who went on a rampage and nobody seemed to know why. But then it became very obvious that there was something that wasn't right about that, because I'm looking at the police reports, you know, the actual interviews that were done at the time when Christopher became a suspect, and every single one, I mean, they interviewed former coworkers of his and friends and many friends who were black, who were African-American, and they all said the same thing. You know, no, they told the police, you're looking at the wrong guy. Joe is my friend. He's never a racist remark from him. You know, I have dinner with him. You know, we socialize together. So I thought, well, this is odd. And just to back up a little bit, Joseph Christopher was 25 years old and had no criminal record. You know, it was before, of course, he came to light as a suspect in these crimes. So it was he was completely under the radar of the police. And when he did become a suspect, it became as a shock to everybody who knew him. I mean, there wasn't even anybody who could come forward and say, well, yeah, you know, sometimes he would be violent. You know, there was really nothing like that. So the more I learned about that, you know, the more intrigued I became to find out, well, wait a minute, well, what happened? I mean, who wakes up at the age of 25 and decides to go on a racist killing spree? That just, you know, that just didn't sound right. You know, there has to be more to it. And I guess at the beginning, I sort of half expected that I'll dig into his background more, and I'm going to find out that maybe very few people knew it, but he was in some neo-Nazi group or something like that. But there was nothing like that. And I really covered my bases. I spoke to his third grade teacher. I spoke to guys who were in Cub Scouts with him. I spoke to high school friends, to employers, to former girlfriend, and eventually to his, you know, closer family members. And there was just nothing. And, of course, the more I discover that, you know, the question becomes, well, what did happen then? And I'll stop there because I don't want to get ahead of myself, but that's really what got me into it. It was sort of that connection to the hometown. You know, the offer of here, you know, our files are open to you if you'd like to write about it. And, you know, then just being completely sucked into the story and thinking, oh, my God, I've got to tell the world about this.
It's interesting how this interview has unfolded. So we won't go back to September 22nd, 1980, as you do in your book. Let's talk about Christopher, his wife, his mother, Therese, and his father, Nicholas, and of course talk about his early life as you do, and you researched to paint a picture of what seems to be fairly normal, but then you went and dug much deeper. So let's talk about Joseph Christopher and the life he had with his parents and his siblings.
Okay. Joseph Christopher was born July 26, 1955, to a couple in Buffalo, New York, ordinary middle-class home. He had two older sisters, and by all accounts, it was a fairly uneventful childhood. You know, the parents lived in what could be described as a, you know, sort of an ordinary family-oriented neighborhood. The only thing that was even remotely significant was that Joseph had a difficult time in school. He was not a good student academically. No behavior problems with him, but academically he didn't seem to be able to catch up with his class, and I guess reading especially was a problem. Well, and they could never figure out why, because he was given an IQ test and he tested, you know, for perfectly normal levels. Well, one thing that I discovered when I was doing this research that could have been the cause was I got his, when he was in his 20s, he had joined the Army, and I got his enlistment and medical records, and his uncorrected vision, meaning his vision without glasses, was 20/200, which means that without glasses, he was legally blind. And to me, I thought, well, maybe that's the answer. I mean, we're talking about the 1960s. This is an era when teachers taught on the blackboard, and
right.
He probably couldn't see. And that was probably his, you know, the difficulty. But I mention that because that did seem to be significant in Joseph's life. His older sisters were very good students, and apparently that did cause conflict, and especially eventually with his father. You know, who wanted him to stay in school and to excel, and Joe struggled with that. And then as he became a teen, Joe eventually dropped out of high school, and that caused a big problem with his parents, his father especially, who was very disappointed about that. But that early, early experience in school with being behind the class, and it should also be mentioned when he was very young, he went to Catholic school, and we're talking about old school Catholic school, where if you weren't, if your grades weren't good, the nuns would try to correct it with a ruler, if you know what I mean, rather than some extra help.
Yeah.
So that does seem to have given him somewhat of an inferiority complex. But other than that, really nothing out of the ordinary in his growing up years. You know, pretty traditional Italian Irish family. Growing up on the East Coast, four kids all together. He had a younger sister eventually. So, you know, certainly nothing that would really stand out. And it wasn't until 1976, when Joe was 20 years old, his father passed away of heart disease. And that, of course, was very difficult for him, as it would be for pretty much anyone. But other than that, we're talking about what could be described as a fairly ordinary upbringing.
You also talk about this, and I agree with you that it's a fairly normal upbringing, and however, everybody reacts to different stimulation differently.
Yes.
You also say that at
Absolutely.
One point that they were definitely admiring of each other, father and son, but at some point that changed, and it changed radically. So you say that you do talk about how that relationship changed and the particulars of, or what that manifests itself in terms of dialogue between them. What would he do in public, and what would he say about
sure.
his son in private?
Okay. According to all the people that I interviewed, and there were many family members and friends and neighbors, Nicholas Christopher, Joseph's father, was highly critical of him. And sometimes, you know, would embarrass him in front of people and, you know, complain about, oh, his, you know, he didn't do this right. And, but it should be said, while I'm not defending, that behavior by any means, it was not terribly atypical for the time for
right.
a father to be very harsh, you know, especially Joseph was the only son. And, but as he got older, it made, unfortunately, it seemed, in Joseph's case, it seems to not have inspired him. You know, his father's constant criticism didn't inspire him, and it instead made him rather self-conscious. So he would try to prove himself to his father, and he was all, by pretty much all accounts, he was also afraid of his father. So, and then when his father died, when Joe was only 20, as one of Joe's first cousins said to me, you know, perhaps Joe felt it all the more keenly because he felt he had never had a chance to prove himself to his father, because like most sons, he wanted his father's approval and respect and love. And, you know, then his father dies rather suddenly, and he never has the chance to, you know, to gain that, to prove himself to his father. So that was certainly, you know, that was something certainly significant, I think, in his adolescence, especially because Joseph started to rebel and, you know, in little ways, you know, and it's unfortunate, but again, it should be said, it wasn't a terribly atypical father-son relationship for the time.
You say that it really affected the entire family when Nicholas died. The father died, and it affected especially Joseph, and it continued to affect him, it seemed, even more so at certain points. But you also talk about that his father had said something previous about military service. So tell us what happens at a certain point with Joseph and this idea that his father had said long before.
Mm-hmm, sure. Well, Nicholas Christopher served in the infantry in World War II. And when Joseph was in high school, his father had suggested to him that he might want to join the Army after high school. And his father apparently thought that the discipline and the regimen would be good for him, because apparently in the father's opinion, he didn't think that Joe had a lot of direction in life. But that's, you know, and it's very hard to say after the fact. Their interests did seem to diverge, and perhaps that was part of the problem, because Nicholas Christopher was a big outdoorsman and enjoyed hunting and whatnot, and so did Joe. But Joe also had an interest in cars. You know, he seemed to be interested in auto mechanics. So he had some interests that were separate from his father's. But anyway, this is a suggestion that his father had made to him, that he might want to join the military for a while. So Nicholas dies, and within a couple of years after that, Joe did try to enlist in the Army, and he was rejected because he had a hernia. He actually scored very high on the Army entrance exams, but they, you know, couldn't take him because of the hernia. So he actually saved the money and for the surgery and had the hernia repaired. And then he, when he was 25, and this would be 1980, he went and he enlisted in the service again. And this time he was accepted. You know, he had the medical problem had been resolved.
You talk also about his personality. Again, all kinds of people said that he was normal, he had friends, but you talk about mm-hmm. that afterwards people talked about a striking difference that occurred. What were some of the things that they noticed were different about Joe?
Okay. When he was about 24 years old, it seemed to come on gradually. To skip ahead, when Joe was in his early 20s, he meets a woman who I call Donna Van Alden in the book.
Right.
And they begin, you know, living together. And everything seems to be going fine for months and months. But then all of a sudden, Joe seems very preoccupied. And he stops talking to her. And his behavior starts to become a little odd. Like he'll go out at night and just walk all night, walk around the city at night, and as if he was, I think it was described as if he was trying to walk his problems. So of course Donna asked him, well, what's wrong? If you know what's bothering you, and he would tell her. Sometimes he would just say nothing, and other times he would say, I don't know. But it was obvious that something was bothering him. So he rather abruptly one day breaks off his relationship with her and tells her, I'm going to be moving home. And what was very unusual about this was that he just, you know, he's the one ending the relationship, and he just started sobbing as if this was, you know, very painful for him. So she didn't understand what was really going on. So he moves back in with his mother and his two sisters. He had two sisters still living at home. And they begin to notice differences in him, too, and eventually it becomes very stark. It started out with he was not socializing anymore. He seemed to be just kind of want to stay around the house and just would be quiet, not talk too much. Then all of a sudden, according to his younger sister, she said to her it seemed like it was overnight, that one day he seemed like this normal guy in his early 20s, messy room, going out with friends. And then the next day, she said, he's wearing, you know, white button-down shirts and corduroy pants and going to church with my mom every day. So, and that was kind of stark. And his sister even said to him, you know, what the hell happened to you? What's going on? You know, and he would just tell her, shut up, mind your own business. And at the same time, he starts withdrawing from friends, from, you know, not just his girlfriend, but he had a best friend who I call Peter Tramontina in the book. And they used to spend all kinds of time together. And Joe was just pulling back from everyone. And then it got to the point where Joe would, he stopped working, and he really wasn't going out of the house much. And he would sort of stare out the windows, you know, as if he was suspicious that someone was trying to break in or something. And again, you know, his mother and his sisters are asking him, what's going on? Are you okay? And, you know, he really wouldn't answer them. He started to ask his mother very odd questions, you know, like tell her, you know, ask her, well, what is the difference between right and wrong? And I mean, and this is a guy who's now 25 years old. Now, his mother, Teresa, felt that he was depressed. She thought that, you know, as she said later, she thought that he was depressed. He was out of work. And she thought, you know, as soon as he gets back on his feet, things will be fine. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. And unbeknownst to her, I mean, he started sleeping with a shotgun in his bed because he became paranoid and he had this morbid fear of intruders. And he started doing very strange things, like he would take all the Tupperware from the kitchen and he would hide it around the house. Or he would hide plastic forks. You know, they would find them in the couch and he was like hoarding them and hiding them. So really strange and bizarre behavior. And on the rare occasions when his friends did see him, they would report, you know, strange things. Like he wouldn't, in one case, he didn't seem to recognize the person. In another case, Peter sees him in the summer on a hot summer day, and Joe is all bundled up in a winter coat and a hat. So it was really odd things like that came on. So by the early fall of 1980, Joe seemed like a very different person than most people had known. Most people close to him had known, but nobody was quite sure what was going on, how much it was going to last, how long it would last. And perhaps, you know, just thought maybe that, well, the mother's right. He's depressed. You know, he's going through a bad time. He's depressed. But, yes, there was over about a year's period of time, there was a gradual but very stark difference in his behavior.
You talk about that he was trying to get work. His mother knew that. He even, because of his religiosity, a sudden super religiosity, he even applied to a seminary, but they refused.
Yes.
So his next application was the military, and he was accepted. Tell us about his stay, especially in the – just tell us about the beginning of his stay in the military. Was it a good experience for him or not?
Well, at the very beginning, it seems to – I mean, there were problems from the very beginning. And whether or not it was a good experience from him, you know, at the very start, only he could say – I mean, judging by some of the letters that he wrote back home, it seemed like maybe the first couple of weeks that he was there in boot camp, you know, the letters seemed perfectly normal to his mother and his sisters. But then again, I mean, I spoke to men who were actually – who were inducted into the service when he was, and they said right from the get-go that his behavior was very strange in a variety of ways. I mean, they were inducted and they were leaving for boot camp in November, and this is in Buffalo, New York, and Western New York, and he wore sandals, you know, to the ceremony, which, I mean, completely inappropriate for the weather. And then one of the guys offered him a ride to the airport because somehow he found out that Joe did not have a ride to the airport and they had a couple hours before they had to catch the plane. So he invites Joe to go home with him. And the family finds him a little strange because he doesn't really talk. I mean, he will answer if he's asked a question, but otherwise he doesn't really engage with them, which is a little odd. And the only thing, and he really won't answer any questions about himself. But on the way to boot camp, he does tell this fellow recruit that he's married and he has a 4-year-old daughter, which was completely untrue. When he asks Joseph about it later, he's just kind of vague and he won't answer questions. Other men, once they get to boot camp, they notice him doing odd things like when they get off the bus, instead of talking to his fellow recruits or something, they saw him holding this blue duffel bag that he would not let go of. And he was walking back and forth in front of the luggage, kind of just sort of smiling and staring off into space, you know, walking back and forth. So it was odd incidents like that. So they start boot camp, and this is just November. And pretty quickly, his fellow recruits find him to be an odd guy. This is an infantry division. For instance, he would get up in the barracks, and he would wander around at night, which is, you know, not something you're not supposed to do. He wouldn't socialize with any of the guys. He wasn't building any relationships. And in one instance, he was in a training exercise with someone in his platoon and got completely carried away and started really attacking. And the drill sergeant even said to him, you know, called it off and said, what's wrong with you? So it was, you know, odd things, very odd things like that that were leading up until Christmas of 1980. And after the Christmas break, when they come back in January of 1981, I interviewed several of the guys who were in his platoon, and the chapter in the book where I really talk about this time after Christmas, my primary interviewee was a man named Leonard Coles, and who figures very significantly in the story. Leonard Coles was in Christopher's platoon, and one day in January of 1981, Christopher, it's a Sunday morning, and men are standing in the barracks, and Joseph Christopher walks up, and he stabs Leonard Coles twice in the chest. Leonard Coles is standing in front of his locker. There's people all around, and for no reason that anyone could figure out, Christopher just walks up and stabs him. So Cole, of course, defends himself. He starts fighting back. Some other guys come, and they break it up. And Leonard Coles has been stabbed twice. He goes to the infirmary. And the men who pulled Christopher off talk about how what a horrible experience it was, not just to see Coles get stabbed, but the way Christopher reacted. They were holding him to the ground, and he was screaming and crying and several said he didn't seem to know where he was or what was going on. He didn't seem to recognize anyone. So it seemed like a complete mental breakdown. So Christopher is put into the stockade, which is the equivalent of jail or prison, and right. He will not speak to anyone. You know, of course, he's asked, well, what happened? Were you and Coles in a fight? Why did you stab him? And he will not speak at all. So Christopher... he arrives in November, and by January, he's in the stockade, charged with attempted murder.
Yes. You also talk about that you say that at first he does not want to talk to anybody, but there is afforded him, just like in regular prison, even though this is a military stockade, the same kind of defense. So there is a Major Morgan that comes, is in charge of being in his defense for these charges.
Right.
So tell us how that proceeds in terms of those criminal military charges.
Okay. Well, Major Morgan is with JAG, and he is a military attorney, and he is assigned to be Christopher's defense attorney. And Major Morgan makes valiant efforts to try to get Joseph Christopher to speak to him and tell him about the incident, tell him what happened, and assures him of attorney-client privilege. You know, I'm your defense attorney. You know, you have to talk to me. I'm here to defend you against court-martial. Christopher won't speak to him. He doesn't trust him. But he doesn't tell him that. He just, so there is just, and at the same time, Christopher starts writing letters home to tell his mother, you know, what has happened and you know, what, that he's in the stockade and what he's done. And his letters to his mother are not only bizarre, but very heartbreaking. You know, you can really see the mental degeneration of, you know, when he talks about, he says, this might not make sense, but this place, I'm paraphrasing here, but this place is turning and I'm getting bad feedbacks. And, you know, so he couldn't explain, but it was just the language that he's using is really bizarre.
Sure.
So there is one person down at, this is at Fort Benning, Georgia, that Christopher asked to speak to, and that is a priest who is assigned, the chaplain who is assigned to Fort Benning. And Joseph does start speaking to him and, you know, confiding in him a bit, really just telling him how distressed he was and how the guys in his platoon are picking on him. You know, at the same time, Christopher goes back and starts going back and forth between the Army psych hospital, psychiatric hospital, and the stockade, because he's in the stockade for a couple weeks in January when he suddenly stops eating, and he will not eat anything, and he will not explain. So eventually, they have to send him to the hospital and force-feed him, and they put him up for psychiatric observation because he lost over 30 pounds. This is someone who was just not eating, just refused. So they restore him to health. At the same time, he gets sent back to the stockade, and for no apparent reason, he attacks a man twice on two different occasions. This is a fellow recruit who was in the stockade, but a black soldier, just out of the blue, just attacks him physically, you know, with his fist. So he's disciplined for that. He will not listen to the guards, and nobody can really communicate with Christopher. As the guards described it, it was very strange. You know, one minute he seems like a normal guy, and then the next, he just, you know, he'll just go off, fly off the handle, and attack someone for no reason. Or he gets put in solitary, and they hear him, you know, talking to himself, and or he'll just sit and stare at a light bulb for hours and hours. So once he's sent back to the stockade, he doesn't last there for terribly long because he injures himself. He somehow gets a hold of a razor blade and cuts his penis and puts a bad cut on the base of his penis. So he's sent back to the hospital and back for psychiatric observation because, of course, injuring one's genitals is considered a potentially serious sign of serious mental disturbance.
Sure.
And while he's there, he starts talking to a couple of the nurses just out of the blue. One, he says, you know, I killed some people in New York. And the nurse, of course, this is not what he's prepared to hear. And he says, well, who? What are you talking about? And, you know, Joseph says, well, I don't know their names, but I think I did this because somebody said my picture was in the newspaper. Now, this is a psychiatric ward, so the nurse isn't quite sure what to do about this, but he reports it to his supervisor. Well, there's another nurse that he speaks to, and he comes up and he asks to speak to her, and he says something very similar. And he said, I killed some people in Buffalo and New York, and she starts questioning him, but he doesn't really seem to know, you know, he doesn't have too much in the way of specifics. And she asks him, well, why did you do this? Why did you kill people? And he says, it was something I had to do. And then the third person he speaks to in the Army is a guard who was assigned to watch over him. And he just wakes up one day after, you know, weeks of not speaking to this man at all and says, did you know that I was a mass murderer in Buffalo? And, of course, the corporal just thinks this is, you know, this again, it's the psychiatric ward. You know, he just tells him, you know, at ease, be still, don't talk. And he said, no, it's true. I killed some people, you know, in Buffalo, New York City. So, of course, these three individuals in the Army, they report to their supervisors, who in turn report to CID, the Army's Criminal Investigation Division. Then they started looking into this. Now, they're already trying to investigate the incident of why Joseph Christopher stabbed Leonard Coles, because they have been able to come up with no reason. They've asked every person who was in the barracks, everyone in the platoon, was there any tension between them, and they keep getting the same answer. No. So one of the men in the Army CID recalls a teletype that has just been transmitted again. And it's an, I guess you would call it an all-points bulletin. It comes from Buffalo, New York, and it describes a series of crimes that happened in from September to December. And it's a series of shootings and stabbings of black males that seemed to were unprovoked. They were blitz-style attacks. And there is a similar teletype from New York City, talking about the same time period, December of 1980. You know, in one day, six black men are attacked by a white man with a knife. So the CID starts looking into it, and they realize that that Joseph Christopher is from Buffalo, New York. That's what's listed as his hometown. And since he's been in the Army, the gentleman he stabbed was named Leonard Coles, who was a black male. The man that he attacked in the stockade was also black. And they decide that, you know, it's worth alerting the authorities in Buffalo and New York City about this, just in case there's some sort of a connection. So they get this. They first call the Buffalo, New York Homicide Division, who immediately sends two detectives down to Fort Benning to do some investigating. And from there, they are able to, after some, you know, an investigation, Christopher will not speak to them. He doesn't believe that they're really police officers from Buffalo. But they are eventually able to get a search warrant for his home, and for his mother's home, actually. And they find some shell casings, which they believe match the shell casings that were found at the scene of the shootings in September in Buffalo. And that's how he is indicted and eventually extradited back to Buffalo to stand trial and charged with three murders.
We're going to use this opportunity, Catherine, to stop for a second to talk about the sponsor of this program tonight, FabFitFun. FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box for women everywhere to discover new brands and products for a life well lived. FabFitFun delivers a box of full-size fashion, beauty, home, fitness, and wellness products, delivered four times a year for just $49.99 a box. And an editor's box is available for purchase in between seasonal boxes with newly discovered items. And FabFitFun makes a great Mother's Day gift. FabFitFun is basically 12 gifts for the price of one. Get your mom gifts from a variety of categories valued at over $200 for only $49.99. My wife Lisa was anxious to receive the FabFitFun box. Inside she found a really nice grocery tote bag that she's going to be using, a deep conditioning mask from Briogeo, from Kate Somerville, exfoliating treatment, and her favorite was the French lavender sponge. There was also glossy lip paint, a couple different kinds. There was bath bombs. There was a cup. There was a really great sleeping eye mask. She was very, very impressed, and she was very, very happy with it. It's a fantastic value. These are full-size products, not samples of anything. Fantastic value. Many products' individual value is more than the entire cost of the box. My wife just got our FabFitFun box, and she loved it. If you haven't signed up yet, it's not too late. Go use my promo code to get $10 off your first box. Use promo code for $10 off the editor's box as well. That's $39.99 for over $200 value. Go to FabFitFun.com to subscribe and use my code MURDER. Try FabFitFun today. Go to FabFitFun.com to subscribe and start getting the box for a life well lived. Use promo code MURDER to get $10 off your first box. That's just $39.99 for products valued at over $200. Again, go to FabFitFun.com. Use my code MURDER to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box. We were just talking about how everything was coming together in this investigation while he's in the military stockade, not wanting to talk to anybody, not believing that the police officers are from Buffalo. He's climbing up. You take us in the book. I reverse the order of everything. But September 22nd, 1980, and a witness named Barbara Wozniak. And tell us about what she hears and what she sees. This is the first reported crime, September 22nd, 1980. Tell us about what she sees and hears and does.
Yes, it's a Monday night, a rainy Monday night, and Barbara Wozniak and her brother are watching Monday Night Football, and all of a sudden she hears what she thinks are firecrackers outside. So she looks out the window, and across the street from Barbara's house is a Top supermarket. And she's in the parking lot, she sees this person, a hoodie, running down the street, running out of the parking lot and then running down the street. And she doesn't think too much of it. She thinks, oh, I don't know, maybe it's just some kid who set off firecrackers or something in the grocery store parking lot. Doesn't think too much of it. Just goes back to watching Monday Night Football. Well, what actually happened was this was a shooting in the Tops parking lot. There was a young man, a 14-year-old named Glenn Dunn, who was sitting in a parked car. And he had driven there with a friend of his named Larry. And Larry went into the store for a few minutes. Glenn was waiting for him in the parked car. And as another witness said, a white man walked up to the car and shot him and shot the driver, 14-year-old Glenn Dunn, and then ran away. And the police, of course, are called to the scene. They pick up the shell casings. They see that they are from a .22 caliber weapon. And they're asking, well, was there an argument between them, anything like that? No, the man just walked up and shot him and then ran away. What's important to remember is this is 1980. This is only 3 years after the Son of Sam case, David Berkowitz, who was the man who, in the summer of 1977, he was going around New York City doing these blitz attacks on strangers, just walk up and shoot strangers and then take off. So now, of course, serial killer is not what comes to mind when the police first go to investigate this. They discover that the car that Glenn Dunn is in is a stolen car. So they start, you know, checking, thinking maybe this is related to, I don't know, some kind of a car theft ring, something of that nature. But the next day, which is a Tuesday afternoon, they get a report from there's a first ring suburb of Buffalo called Cheektowaga. And there is a man, a black male, who is sitting in his car eating lunch at a Burger King parking lot and at the noon hour. And witnesses report that a white man walks up to his car, shoots Harold Green through his car window, and then runs off. And now this suburb, Cheektowaga, this is just not a long distance from where Glenn Dunn was shot the night before, police. You know, they're wondering, they don't really think that at that point that it's related, but it's interesting that these two men were just shot in their cars. They're both black males. Other than that, they have nothing in common. Harold Reed is 32 years old. He's an engineer. Well, on Tuesday night, about 11 o'clock, a man named Emmanuel Thomas, a black man in his early 30s, married family man, is walking down the street where he lives with a friend of his. And a white man walks up and shoots at him and unfortunately hits him in the head and takes off. And Emmanuel Thomas dies at the scene. So now the police have these three killings, you know, shootings of black men that have all happened with a .22 caliber weapon by what witnesses say just a lone white male. And they're obviously going to run ballistics tests to see if these are connected. Well, before the ballistics tests even come back, Wednesday morning, there is a black man named Joseph McCoy who was walking down a street in Niagara Falls, New York, which, of course, is very close to Buffalo as well. And witnesses report a white man walks up to him on the street, grabs him around the neck, and shoots him in the head, and then takes off. And also, other slugs. Well, very quickly, it's determined that the 22 caliber shell casings from these four shootings are connected. They have come from the same weapon. Now, the descriptions of the shooters vary quite a bit, except for the only commonality is they all the witnesses agree that it was a white male. But other than that, the descriptions are kind of all over the map as far as his age and height and things like that. But the police know that, okay, well, something's going on, because they delve into the backgrounds of these victims. The four victims are not related. They don't know each other. There's nothing in common. So this causes a lot of fear, and especially panic, and particularly in the black community, thinking, you know, what's going on? We have this serial killer who's just killing black men at random. So there's definitely an atmosphere, you know, of fear, and the police really have no leads, because these are blitz attacks. There's the only evidence left is the shell casing. Well, about 2 weeks after these crimes, there are two absolutely horrific crimes that happen. Again, in the first ring suburbs of Buffalo, there is a man named Parler Edwards, who is a cab driver, and he is found bludgeoned and horribly bludgeoned, and with his heart cut out in the back of his taxi cab. The following night, a taxi cab driver named Ernest Jones is found similarly bludgeoned and with his heart cut out by a boat ramp. And again, the only thing that these victims seemed to have in common were they were both cab drivers, and they were both black males. Now, these crimes are entirely different from the Blitz shootings, but of course, you know, when it comes out in the press of what's happened, there's the fear, like, oh my God, is the serial killer just upped his game, so to speak, and just gotten more brutal in his killing? So it really causes a lot of fear and panic, and unfortunately, it causes a lot of racial tension, and there starts to be retaliation-type crimes. There are, now, not a lot of them, but of course, you know, they get the negative attention. There are a couple of, there was a black motorist who ran down two white men, you know, on the street, you know, at random. And then it was incidents like that, and many reports for a couple nights in a row of black teenagers throwing rocks and bottles and whatnot at any white people that they saw in cars, you know, So a horrible situation has suddenly gotten much, much worse. And there's a lot of pressure on the police and on elected officials, you know, to, of course, catch the killer, which there always is in these situations. It's driven by fear. But in this case, there are also the accusations of, well, you know, the police aren't trying hard enough because the victims are all black. Now, of course, that wasn't true. And if you look at the records, the police records and the files, they were trying very hard. I mean, they were canvassing and re-canvassing, and, you know, very early on involved the FBI, you know, trying to analyze their evidence. But in a case like this, where there's just no, these kind of random attacks, which fortunately are really very rare, stranger on stranger violence is really relatively rare. In cases like this, where there's absolutely no connection between killer and victim, and there is no evidence left behind, because they only have fleeting contact, so we're not talking about fingerprints, you know, even today, there would have been no DNA, because this is just such a brief encounter, and there was no direct contact between the victim and the killer.
Right.
So it's a very, very difficult case for the police. But of course, you know, the community is afraid, and there's so it was causing a lot of tension, a lot of ill will, and just fear, and it was really difficult time. And it's also worth mentioning that this happened at a very difficult time economically. This is the late 1980, and cities like Buffalo, New York, are really suffering economically.
Sure.
This is the area that became known as the Rust Belt, because, you know, this is, you know, the factories had been closing, and there's very high unemployment, and I think a time like that really just exacerbates, you know, when things are bad anyway, and people are filled with uncertainty and fear, and you know, that constant economic struggle, then to have something like this happen, I think it makes it all the more, it heightens things even more, and frightens people all the more. So that was the fall of 1980, and then suddenly the killing stopped. Early October was when the two cab drivers were murdered, and then there were no other killings that were either like the cab drivers or that could be connected to the shootings, the .22 caliber shootings, as they came to be called. All was quiet until December of 1980, a couple months later. December 22nd, 1980, in New York City, which is about less than 500 miles from Buffalo, single day, there are 6 black men attacked in Manhattan by a knife-wielding white man who attacks them mostly on the subways. It has an eerie similarity to the shootings in the sense that these are unprovoked attacks. 2 of the men survive. There are 4 of the men, unfortunately, die. 2 of the men who were attacked survive. And they report, I've never seen this man. It was just this short white guy, and he just came up and he stabbed me, and he ran away. So authorities in Buffalo hear about this, and they're wondering if this serial killer is back, because that sound, even though these were knife attacks and they had been investigating 22 caliber shootings, they're thinking there's an eerie similarity there. You know, the weapon is different, but the MO is the same. It's a blitz-style attack on a stranger from a white man who just runs away. Well, you know, they talk about it. New York City detectives at the time are very skeptical and think, well, you know, who's going to travel, you know, almost 500 miles for this killing spree? Well, they're skeptical for a couple of days until they have a similar string of stabbings of black men happens in Buffalo and in Rochester. And very similar to New York City, a man just standing on the street or minding his own business, and a white man comes up and stabs him. So now authority, especially the task force in Buffalo, they're convinced that he's back. This is the so-called 22 caliber killer. And he switched weapons, but this has got to be the same guy. Then once again, in early January, it just stops. After the spate of attacks over a few days, over the Christmas holidays, then it just stops. And we know, in hindsight, that was because Joseph Christopher returned to Fort Benning, Georgia. He returned to the Army after his Christmas break. He had been, when the investigators started, when they were called to Fort Benning and they started investigating, they discovered that he was in New York City and then in Buffalo over the Christmas holidays, giving him opportunity to commit those crimes.
Let's talk about how important, it might be not important in the way people might have hoped, but the importance of composite drawings and the importance, we'll see what we mean by that, the importance of eyewitness testimony in creating those composites. You talked about a central figure in this, a Detective John Reagan was involved in the very first murder investigation, and sort of a relentless re-interviewing technique, getting down to another central character, Kenny Paulson, which was a witness to the very first murder and the Joseph Christopher. But we won't get into that right now. Let's talk about just a little bit about that composite drawing and what was involved in that.
Sure. Well, after the first shootings in September of 1980, there were composite drawings made from eyewitness descriptions. And in fact, they even had, because of the possible civil rights violations with the black men being attacked, the FBI got involved in the case. And they had an FBI artist actually meet with several of the witnesses and put together a set of composite drawings. And then after the series of stabbings that happened in December, the same artist came up with what were supposedly perfected versions of these composite drawings, which really look identical to the first set that had been released in the fall. The composite drawings actually bear absolutely no resemblance whatsoever to Joseph Christopher.
Yeah.
Basically, the composites, both sets of composites show a man who is blonde, appears to be, you know, very fair-skinned. The features are completely different, you know, rather thin lips. Joseph Christopher, when he's arrested, he has very dark curly hair. He has a very prominent nose. He has very thick lips. Really, his photo is night and day, to the point where it was actually that those composite drawings were actually parodied in newspapers, you know, for their absolute lack of resemblance to the suspect who was eventually arrested.
Now, you talk about how we already mentioned that he was arrested and he was deported from Fort Benning, Georgia, to Buffalo for this grand jury indictment. They were successful and indicted him. What about the idea of the psych evaluation. Tell us about how that proceeded and how the media, were the media taking the facts and running with them, or was there more to that in terms of the linkage between the cabbie killings and the what considered the 22 caliber killings definitively?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, right away, as soon as he's brought back to Buffalo, when Christopher's extradited back to Buffalo, his mother had hired two excellent defense attorneys for him. Christopher will not speak to them, and
yeah.
Right away they realized, well, he needs a psychiatric evaluation. Just reading, I mean, this is someone who was in the psychiatric hospital in the Army and had cut himself and wouldn't eat, and his behavior is bizarre. And in fact, the Army had advised Buffalo police when they gave them this tip that, you know, you might want to look at this guy. Say, you know, he will more than likely never be court-martialed in the Army because he's psychotic. So that starts a very, very long round of psychiatric evaluations and examinations. And what was at play here was the defense attorneys almost immediately are able to determine that they have a client who is, they're not doctors, they can't diagnose him, but has mental problems, serious mental problems. They can't communicate with him, and how are they supposed to defend him if they can't communicate? At the same time, you know, when there's news of an arrest of the 22 caliber killer suspect, there is, great pressure on the district attorney to prosecute, you know, and get this case prosecuted, and we need this wrapped up, and we need justice, justice, justice. So, and as far as the media, of course, this was a huge story, you know, across New York State. And, you know, the media really kind of runs with it, and there's all kinds of speculation. Well, is the 22 caliber killer also responsible for the cabbie killings? Now, the police already had, and the district attorney's office already had their hands full, you know, just trying to build a case against Christopher for the three shootings. He was indicted for the first three 22 caliber shootings.
Right.
Because it's difficult to make a case. They really don't have much in the way of evidence except for these shell casings, which, you know, might prove that he may have had access to the weapon. But as I said, the witness descriptions are all over the place, and they don't have anything else really in the way of direct physical evidence. They have Christopher's confessions, which were made in a psychiatric hospital after he had cut himself and wasn't eating. And so, you know, the confessions, you know, sketchy there. But there was, because the cabbie killings had been so horribly gruesome, and they had happened so soon after the shootings, there was maybe it was kind of natural for the press to want to connect the dots. And of course, they were asking the question, you know, is this did he also commit these crimes? Now, of course, he was not indicted for those cab driver murders, and the task force continued quietly to continue investigating the cab driver murders. Now, it was becoming clear, it was pretty clear early on to the scientific, and especially to the scientific investigative team that was on the task force, that these crimes were not related whatsoever. And in fact, profiler John Douglas, when he, back in October, even with the little information that he had about the cab drivers, said that it's not absolutely impossible that it's not the same offender, but unlikely. You know, he advised them, he said, you are more than likely looking for two separate offenders there. So
now, despite that, you talk about the esteemed John Douglas profiler, and that it was a good profile, but you talk about mm-hmm. the prosecution, and they really like their psychiatric witness, Dr. Barton. How did Barton portray the other two murders, the cabbie murders that, again, you say that were never proven? What was his approach in terms of, for the prosecution, what was his tone and approach?
Okay. Well, it's important to note that Christopher was, Dr. Barton was the prosecution's psychiatrist for the second trial. Christopher was convicted of the three 22 caliber shootings in 1981, but that conviction was later overturned. by an appeals court that decided that his attorney should have been able to introduce more evidence of his, you know, psychiatric condition. Christopher was retried on the 22 caliber shootings in 1985, and that's when the psychiatrist named Dr. Russell Barton was brought on board. And he was known as a psychiatrist who was very friendly to the prosecution, so much so that the district attorney in Rochester actually had him on retainer. And how this all came about was Barton did a videotaped interview with Joseph Christopher, in which Christopher, and remember, we're skipping ahead several years here,
sure,
after, you know, Christopher had been in prison and he was in and out of psychiatric hospitals, you know, for years in between. He conducts an interview with Christopher where Christopher is admitting to all kinds of things, now including the cab driver killings. Now, what Christopher tells Dr. Barton is wrong. You know, his confession to the cab driver killings is absolutely wrong. But unfortunately, this is used in court against him, even though he's not on trial for these crimes. The prosecutor seizes on that and, sort of uses it in his argument because this time around they were trying to use they had advanced a psychiatric defense for Christopher. And the prosecutor advances that theory that, well, but look how vicious he is. You know, he killed these cab drivers and cut their hearts out, which was really great. You know, in retrospect, it's grossly unfair. I mean, it wasn't appropriate at the time because Christopher hadn't even been charged with these. But particularly if you look at the evidence, it's abundantly clear that Joseph Christopher had nothing to do with those cab driver murders. By that time, 1985, his mental illness, his mental state had degenerated to the point where he would have confessed to the Lindbergh kidnapping, essentially.
Sure.
You know, really too bad. And this is actually where the title of the book came from, is Absolute Madness, because what I discovered when I started really looking into the case, as I mentioned earlier, you know, it just didn't make sense that Joseph Christopher, you know, had committed these crimes. And in fact, when it was, there was an article in the newspaper before my book came out, you know, talking about how I was writing the story, I had a couple of Joseph Christopher's black friends seek me out to tell me Joe was not a racist. Joe was a good guy. I don't know what happened to him, but,
right,
you know, he wasn't. And what it was in a nutshell is, very unfortunately, Joseph Christopher developed paranoid schizophrenia. And that was really the cause of the crime spree that he went on, the changes in his behavior. And what makes this doubly heartbreaking is that Joe realized at some point that his mind, there was something wrong. And he tried to talk to, you know, his former girlfriend and then his best friend, you know, Peter, but really couldn't even explain to them what was happening. Well, just days before the first shooting, which was the murder of Glenn Dunn, Joseph Christopher went to the Buffalo Psychiatric Hospital and asked to be admitted. He actually sought help. He didn't know, obviously he had no background in psychiatry, he didn't know what was wrong with him, but he knew something was wrong, and he asked to be admitted to the psychiatric hospital, and he was turned away. It lasted about 30 minutes, and they suggested that he get counseling. And that was especially jarring for me. I mean, the whole story is heartbreaking.
Sure.
But what's really disturbing is that we still hear about incidences like that, where someone who needs mental health help, you know, they realize at some level that you know, something wrong, and they need help. They seek the help and they don't get it. They're turned away. And then often with really tragic consequences. So that was something that really gripped me when it came to this story. Because if you look at his history, if you look at Joe's history up until he became ill, when he was about 24, 25, this was a good guy. And his mind betrayed him. I mean, this is someone who became profoundly mentally ill through no fault of his own. And the consequences were beyond tragic.
It certainly seems that that they could have. It seems unthinkable that the whole judicial system couldn't concur and sentence him to an indefinite term in a mental institution as punishment, given the circumstances and everything that you've revealed in this book, and it was evident to them as well. That seems to be an incredible shame. Not that I think that people should avoid punishment, but this man was clearly insane. So.
Yes, he was. And actually, I interviewed one of the prosecutors, the junior prosecutor on the second case, and they realized that he was this was not a case of malingering. This is someone who really was legitimately mentally ill, and that's why he had committed his crimes. And you know, as you said to me, he wanted to offer him, you know, a plea, so to speak, where it would have been a mental defect. And that does not mean that he would have walked away. That means that he would have been sent to a mental institution rather than a state prison. Unfortunately, it was because of the political aspects of it. In fact, there was a closed-door meeting with the senior prosecutor and some of the DA and the black leaders in the community who, when the senior prosecutor, Albert Rainey, came out, you know, he told Tom Iwano, who was the junior prosecutor on the case, he said, no, he says, they want to hang him. They're not going to give, you know, because he was a white man who had killed black men. And there was sort of the political component to it, which is very unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do write about the prosecutor portraying Joseph as a psychopath. And so, you know, I mean, when you get that strong portrayal of him enjoying cutting out the hearts of his victims, that will sway a jury,
which,
I would think.
Right, which never happened. Well, I know, which is, it's terribly unfair because it never happened.
Yeah, and you really, we really just touched on, well, really didn't touch on it. People are going to have to read the book to talk about the time with Jesse Jackson, Reverend Smith, Detective Reagan, jurisdictions that were more cooperative, some less cooperative, eyewitness accounts, and then we have Kenny Paulson, the reluctant witness, then the lineup. Mm-hmm. It is a truly fascinating case that we just really touched on the surface. I want to thank you very much, Catherine, for coming on and talking about Absolute Madness, a true story of a serial killer, race, and a city divided. It's been a pleasure. For those that might want to look at other material, or do you have a Facebook page for this? Tell us how they might look at other material or your website. Tell us.
Yes, I do, Dan. My website is, my name is CatherinePellinaro.net, and they can also find me on Facebook. I have an author page and also a page for the book, Absolute Madness. So if they just put that in the search engine, it should come right up.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. You have a great evening.
Thank you, Dan. It's been a pleasure for me, too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.